DNA may have brought closure to a decades-old case in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. He was known as the pillowcase rapist who terrorized dozens of women in South Florida back in the 80s. Police used DNA they gathered from the suspect's son. Also, is conversion therapy a religious rite? The Florida ACLU will explain as it challenges a series of laws being proposed in the legislature which could take away rights for the LGBTQ. Finally, there are still thousands of Holocaust survivors living in Florida, but many of them are struggling with basic care and needs. Why are nursing homes sometimes just not an option for these folks? And
the perception is that only a Jewish teacher should be teaching the Holocaust, but it's a history course.
How is the Holocaust being taught in Florida schools? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. In a recent Miami Commission meeting, a Miami police captain made a claim that astounded everyone.
I'm a black male. Yes, I am. And I am non-Hispanic. I was born in this country. I never went to Cuba. I never went to Spain. Really, again, I didn't put this speech together. This is who I am.
That's Cuban Javier Ortiz, who identifies as black. Now, these remarks have made national news, and civil rights organizations are calling for the Miami police captain to be fired. Ortiz was suspended with pay. The city's police chief is expected to meet with human resources and city attorneys about Ortiz later this week. We're joined now by the Miami Herald's Chuck Raven, joining us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Chuck has also been following the arrest of the suspected pillowcase rapist, and we're going to get to that story later. Chuck, great to have you back.
Thanks, Lewis. Appreciate it.
What's happening, or I wonder what's happening in the moments just before Ortiz makes this statement? I mean, he's standing in front of the commission, and what was happening in those moments before why he would make that statement?
So the president of the black police union in the city, his name is Stanley Jean Poix, he was airing out grievances that union had, some including promotions, and he mentioned Ortiz in particular, how he'd been promoted despite dozens of internal complaints from people outside the department and inside the department of things that, you know, happened in the past.
So he makes this statement, and I mean, tell me, what was the reaction at that point from the people in the room?
Well, what happened was Ortiz was given the Keon Hardiman, who chairs the commission, told him he could respond. He came up. He made the statement that you guys just played before, and it was kind of deafening silence for a couple of seconds. People were pretty stunned.
Now, he claims that he is a black man because of the one drop rule. Remind us of what that is.
Okay, the one-drop rule goes back to slavery. It's an old racist trope that basically says if there is any black ancestry anywhere in your family, you're considered black. And, I'm not even certain that Javier understood exactly what he was saying at that point.
And when he made that mention, what was the reaction at that for that comment?
It was stunned silence. I don't believe he was admonished for it because I don't think people thought he understood what he was saying exactly, to be honest with you.
Tell us about Javier Ortiz. Who is he? How long he's been in the force?
So he's been around a couple of decades. He is a former president of the Fraternal Order of Police, which represents the city's police officers. He always had a social media presence. It really started blooming in about 2016. And he just felt, you know, that when he went to social media, he went under, you know, as a civilian or as a representative of the FOP, so he didn't feel he had to be held to the same standards as most police officers. He also helped negotiate a settlement a few years back that had to do with about a decade ago after the markets crashed. And the city cut some salaries and stuff. So he helped negotiate a settlement where they won millions and millions of dollars back. And he was given some juicy promotions after that.
Let's talk about some of the complaints filed against him. And you talked about social media as well. Some of the things that he had said on social media that kind of enraged people. But what are some of the complaints filed against him while he was on duty?
There were some use of force complaints, but that's not all that unnatural, you know, when you're out on the street patrolling. A lot of them were social media complaints. There was, you know, there was a woman that videotaped an officer giving her a speeding ticket, and for some reason that outraged Javier, and he basically posted her cell phone number and told people to call her, and he also got into that famous, it wasn't really an argument, but he came out against Beyonce when she was about to start her world tour in Miami, and that kind of freaked out the mayor, who thought he was tainting the city. So he's had some issues.
Has he gotten in trouble for anything he's done in the past?
He was suspended about the woman with the video a while ago. It had to do with a restraining order that was sought for him. Otherwise, he hasn't really, you know, each time the chief has looked into something, it's really difficult to suspend or fire a police officer because of union agreements and collective bargaining and such.
So now you've got groups like the NAACP saying he should be fired. What's happening right now in the investigation?
Yeah, they're upset, rightly so, probably. And they're asking for him to be fired. The city, you know, the chief, George Colina, met with city attorneys and human resources, like you stated before, and they figured they could suspend him with pay. The suspension, I do not believe, has anything to do, though, specifically with Ortiz's statement. I think it's a separate investigation that is being looked at by an outside agency. The only incidents that we know is that a civilian panel has been questioning the hours that Captain Ortiz has been working in off-duty jobs and saying he's been double dipping, and they passed that along to the state attorney. I'm not exactly certain where that is right now.
Again, coming back to the statement that he calls himself a black man, have you heard from any other police officers or the union, especially black officers?
The black officers are horrified. The union took issue with what he said, you know, and these are people that he's been close with for a long time. They said they'll support him, but ultimately it's up to a vote by union members if he's looking for any kind of support, you know, as far as attorneys and representation and stuff like that. He can always hire, you know, outside on his own. That would be up to him later on down the road, depending on what happens.
And I need to clarify again, he identifies as a black man. That's what he has said.
That's what he says.
Right. Yes. What have you heard from the community, from your readers?
Many people are outraged. There's also been supporters, you know, with social media and how it works today. A lot of people have been questioning why people are picking on Captain Ortiz and bringing up Elizabeth Warren and her claim of, you know, ancestry. But it's easy to attack on social media, so.
I'm talking with Chuck Rabin, reporter for the Miami Herald. We've been talking about a Miami Police Department Captain Javier Ortiz, who recently told city leaders that he identifies as a black man. He's been suspended with pay by the police chief, and again, there is an investigation. Chuck's also been following this other story, the arrest of the suspected pillowcase rapist. Now, this is a man who's suspected of raping more than 40 women from 1981 to 1986 in South Florida, and the arrest came because it was a DNA match to at least two dozen Miami-Dade sexual assaults. Now, just a warning, we're going to talk about some stuff here, that some content that may be disturbing to some listeners. Chuck, who is Robert Kohler?
So Robert Kohler is a 60-year-old who has several addresses going back to the early 80s. It seems like he mostly did not transient work, but he worked as like a cable installer, and he worked at a delicatessen at some point. He lived in South Miami. It seems that he has family up in the Lake Worth area. So he's kind of like the normal person who would just, you know, live in the shadows like everybody else, going to work every day and doing whatever they do.
And in the 80s, authorities had actually, they launched a task force to look for this attacker. But what happened to it?
It disbanded after about a year. I believe it just, they just didn't get out of it what they were hoping to get out of it. He was very careful. It was hard to track him, even though he was showing up at some places, almost coming back to the exact spot he was at before. and it just kind of went by the wayside after a couple of years.
How did he get the nickname the pillowcase rapist?
What he would generally do is he would break into apartments, mainly of professional women in their, 30s. He did deviate, and he'd go after an older woman once in a while. And he would sneak up, usually at night, after watching them and surveying them and seeing what was going on. And he would threaten to kill them if they screamed, and he would cover their face, usually with a pillow or by a pillowcase, before he raped them.
So decades later, they finally, again, they suspect that this is the man. How did they make the arrest?
So what happened was, I'm not sure of the exact date, but his son was arrested a little while ago on some type of domestic incident. DNA was taken from his son, and it matched to Kohler's DNA from a rape back in 83, I believe, in which they saved the rape kit. From a Kendall woman, I think, around Christmas time. And so then police went and found where Robert Kohler was living, and they trailed him. And they actually picked up DNA samples that he left behind out in public in different places. And they tested it, and it came back, as far as they're concerned, a positive match. Then they went and started trying to get as many samples as they could of suspected, of victims that he was suspected of attacking. And as of Friday, I think they'd matched it up to more than 24.
And did they ever use, because there was something in the story about one of these websites that, does DNA for ancestry. Was that ever used in some way?
I don't know exactly what website they used. I know that the police said they did use some sort of ancestry website. I'm not certain on the specifics of it. I believe you may have to get permission from family members. I don't know exactly how that worked, so I want to be careful about that. But they went through some kind of family tree as far as DNA is concerned.
Is it true that detectives want to go back and re-interview a lot of these women who were victims?
Yeah, they're trying to contact as many as they can. A lot of David Ovalle did a story on a couple of victims who were kind enough to speak to him, and were glad that things weren't forgotten. And, it seems like a lot of people, it brings up bad memories, but they, they're happy and content to come and tell their story and see if this is the guy.
What have police said about the fact that, again, this is a case, we're talking about cases that go back almost 40 years?
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if they said anything about the fact that it's taken this long.
They have said they're happy they caught the guy. Remember, this was all before DNA was such a hot thing and so helpful. So he was I don't know if drifter's the right word, but he certainly moved a lot according to the addresses that you find in public records and documents and stuff. So he was careful. He was hard to tail, and they did save DNA samples through rape kits that were collected earlier, which they matched them to. But I can't tell you, obviously the DNA matched, but it took until his son was arrested recently.
Do the police spend a lot of time? Do they put a lot of investment into cold case files? Or, again, is it just a matter of somebody gets arrested and maybe you're lucky and you can go back and resolve an old case?
No, they're pretty good about cold cases. They have kind of a robust force, especially in Miami-Dade, and they have I don't know exactly how many officers are working on it, but they do look into cold cases. They try to go back and, contact victims and keep up with what's going on, and every once in a while they get a pop.
And so how is the new technology and new our understanding of DNA, how is that helping them in some of those old cases?
Well, it's so for certain, right? I mean, you're 99.9% sure that it's a person based on your DNA matches. So it can only work if there were DNA samples that were saved decades ago, like in rape kits, or in other things. So it's helped tremendously. I mean, you've seen, groups, civil rights groups that have been out there and all the people that have been released from prison over the years, and it's been helping out.
This is one of those just fascinating and strange cases, but again, decades later, may have finally solved it. Chuck Rabin, again, reporter for the Miami Herald, speaking with us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Chuck, always a pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis. Appreciate it, man.
All right, still to come, the Florida ACLU takes on lawmakers over a series of bills. We're going to talk to you about some of those coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Florida Supreme Court recently ushered guidance on a hotly contested issue that has now moved to federal court. The passage of Amendment 4 by Florida voters back in 2018 restored the right to vote for former felons, and that's expected to impact up to 800,000 people in the state of Florida. Again, the Florida Supreme Court sided with Governor DeSantis in requiring felons pay back all fines and fees before regaining that right. It's now in federal court. Micah Kubik is the executive director of the Florida chapter of the ACLU, and he joins us to discuss this and some other controversial bills that have been filed by the Florida legislature. We're going to talk about those as well. Micah, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So help me understand the argument that the Florida Supreme Court made in its ruling. All fines and fees are required to be paid back before individuals can regain the right to vote, correct? That's what it is.
So the Florida Supreme Court issued this opinion after Governor DeSantis asked them to.
And it wasn't a decision, it was an opinion that
the
governor asked for.
It's purely an advisory opinion. Florida has this weird sort of system where the governor can at any time go to the Supreme Court and ask them what they think about something. And in this particular case, it's interesting that the governor waited until after he had signed the bill, waited months after discussion about this had started to go and ask the Florida Supreme Court what they thought. At the end of the day, though, what's really important is that this is in federal court, and what the Supreme Court of Florida did was talk about the Florida state constitution and their opinion of it. But in our system in the United States, the federal constitution is the one that matters, and the federal constitution is the one that says that your ability to vote shouldn't be based on your ability to pay.
So after the voters passed this, because you believe this is a contradiction to what the voters basically decided in 2018.
Absolutely. The voters wanted 1.4 million people to have their right to vote restored, their citizenship restored, and their full human dignity restored.
And the lawmakers came back and said, okay, yes, but only after you pay your fines and fees, you've done your time. And they believe that fines and fees is part of that. That's what lawmakers argued.
So what Florida lawmakers did was get involved in a situation that they didn't have to get involved in at all. When voters passed Amendment 4, it should have been a done deal. But Florida's legislature decided right away that they wanted to make it hard for folks to register. And so they said any outstanding fees, fines, restitution, payments had to be made first. And that counts as a poll tax and counts as a way of stopping people who should be eligible.
Is the federal case right now basically examining whether individuals can pay those fines and fees back?
So we know for a fact that most folks have real challenges paying back these fees and fines. They're huge amounts of money. You know, some journalists looked at it and found that in Broward County and Palm Beach County alone, just two out of the 67 counties in Florida, the total amount owed was over $1 billion, billion with a B. We're talking about real money here. And a lot of cases, folks who are coming back from incarceration find it difficult to find a job, to find housing, to get services. And so the idea that they would be able to pay back billions and billions of dollars is just silly on its face. But moreover, it's just wrong. This is America. We don't say here that your ability to vote is based on whether or not you have cash in your pocket.
I do want to mention that our reporter Danny Rivera has been covering this issue, and so you can follow his stories on our website at WLRN.org. How is the federal court, though, going to decide? How can any court decide whether a person can pay back these fines and fees?
So the judge already issued an injunction. A federal judge issued an injunction back in the fall saying that this system that the legislature had set up and the Governor DeSantis endorsed was wrong, that your ability to pay can't determine whether you get to vote. And what he said was they now have a chance to create a system to make sure that folks who don't have the ability to pay are not stopped from voting. And now it's in the legislature's hand. They have the ball in their hand for these 3 months that they're there to figure out a system that will withstand the scrutiny that the judge is going to give to them. And so far, you know, we're only a couple weeks into the legislative year, but so far, not a one of them has popped their head up to try and do something like that. There's not been a bill. They seem to be content just to let it ride on by. And then when the judge comes back in April, I don't think he's going to like that very much.
I want to stick on this line, though, the ability to pay back these fines and fees. I mean, again, how is that determined? Is it you have a regular, stable job, that you have maybe some support in being able to pay that back? That's the thing that's sticking with me at the moment.
So I think there are any number of ways that you could determine whether somebody has the ability to pay or not. They could sign an affidavit, for example, a legal document under penalty of perjury that they don't have the ability to pay. In the federal system, that is oftentimes what happens. But I think the more important point here is that it really is contrary to what the voters asked for in the first place, which is that when you complete your sentence, when these things are completed, and when the financial obligations are turned from a criminal thing into a civil item, a civil lien, they shouldn't stop you from voting at all. There are hundreds of thousands of people in this state who have civil liens, who have obligations that they owe, and we don't stop them from voting. The idea that we should do that here is ridiculous.
So again, as you mentioned, the legislature is just a couple of weeks in. It is today. It is in Atlanta at the federal court. But we've got a primary coming up in Florida in less than 2 months. And then, of course, November's general election. I mean, is it possible that this could be decided, that felons would have the opportunity to partake in either of these two elections coming up?
So I think it's unlikely that returning citizens will have the chance to participate in the March presidential primary, other than the folks who are directly covered by the lawsuit that's going on now that the ACLU and SPLC and others and NAACP and the League are pursuing. But in time for the August state primary and the November presidential election, I think that's absolutely likely. The judge in the federal case is going to give us a ruling, a full trial in April, and that's when we'll know about what he's going to do, what he's going to order the state to do. And that will give ample time for folks to register and participate in August and November. We hope the legislature does something in the meantime, though, and does what it's supposed to do.
I'm speaking with Micah Kubik, the executive director for the Florida chapter of the ACLU. The ACLU is involved in a federal case surrounding Amendment 4, which restores voting rights for former felons. The Florida ACLU is also closely watching a lot of ongoing legislation right now. Let's talk about some of these other bills. There are bills that pertain to LGBTQ rights that have raised concerns for your organization. A number of municipalities across Florida have banned the controversial practice of gay conversion therapy, including here in Miami, but a bill would overturn the local bans. How prevalent is this practice still in the state of Florida, by the way?
So it seems like it is an ongoing practice, one that a number of places have going on, and that's why so many local governments have decided to intervene and try and ban these practices within their jurisdictions.
And remind us of what the practice is, what this conversion therapy is.
So conversion therapy is a sort of way that medical practitioners, or sometimes folks who don't have any medical license at all, decide to try and quote-unquote convert people who are LGBT and force them into not being LGBT. And it's a practice that has been decried as torture, that has been decried as cruel, and that almost every accredited medical organization in the country has disowned.
So what the legislature right now is trying to pass isn't just that it allows conversion therapy, but it's just saying local municipalities do not have the power to ban this. It's a state issue. This comes back to state power over local power.
I think that's true, but I also think that it's true that the folks who are supportive of these particular bills think that conversion therapy is objectively a good thing and strongly object to the idea of local governments banning it because they claim that it is a violation of their religious rights.
That's what it gets down to. They say this is about religious rights. How does the ACLU balance the rights of a person's religion to, again, the concerns of a practice like this?
So I think there is a movement afoot in this country right now to undermine all of the progress that we have made as a country on LGBT equality. And a lot of times that movement to undermine that progress is dressed up in the language of religious freedom, right? This is dressing up discrimination and it's costuming cruelty in the language of religious freedom. You absolutely have a right in this country to practice your religion, to worship how you want and where you want and when you want and with whom you want. but you do not have a right in this country to hurt other people and call that your religious freedom. And that's really what's going on here.
There's another bill. This one would repeal a local ordinance that protects LGBTQ workers. There currently aren't federal protections for individuals to be fired for their sexual orientation. What are the dangers facing employees here in Florida who are open about their orientation?
So it's a huge risk. It remains true, as you said, that in both the state and the country, you can be fired for being gay at the workplace. You can be fired in many places. You can be denied public accommodations. You can be denied housing. And all over Florida, local governments have passed local ordinances because the state refused to do so. The state has refused year over year over year over year to do anything to extend protection to LGBT people.
Why is that? What do you hear from people? Why is it taking so long?
I think the simple answer is just that there's not a will to do it among the folks who are in the leadership of the legislature. They don't think it's important, or they don't think that LGBT people deserve protection in the first place. They are okay with discrimination. That's what it boils down to. But local governments around the state have said that is not good enough. That's not our values. That's not who we are. And so they've passed ordinances to protect people. And now these two bills have been introduced in the legislature that would effectively get rid of the progress that has been made and take away protections for 13 million Floridians.
There are some other key bills that you're keeping an eye on. Of course, one of the really big ones, and this was discussed on the Florida Roundup last week, the issue of the contested parental consent bill, which would require minors to gain consent before receiving an abortion. This is, again, moving quickly through both chambers. How do you see this playing out this term?
So it seems pretty likely that it will go before the full legislature as early as this week. I think this is a bill that is clearly unconstitutional, that violates the rights that folks have to make decisions about their own health care. And it is just absurd on its face. The idea that we would be forcing children, that's what we're talking about here, forcing children to have children against their will is ridiculous. It's cruel. It's inhumane. And it's not the sort of values that we should be broadcasting. It's also important to note that Florida already has a law that requires that parents be notified when a child is going to have an abortion. And so the idea that now we're going to require consent really goes above and beyond and is going to hurt those children who are already the most vulnerable, who have the most difficult, tumultuous relationships with their parents, and who are victims in other ways.
If it passes through the legislature, you think the governor will sign it?
I think he's been pretty clear that he's going to.
And look, I mean, the other thing, too, is this, is that he's also that Republicans have had control of the House and Senate and the governor's office. And this past last year, they were able to put new judges in the Florida Supreme Court. So they believe that they have this is on their side now. What do you think happens after that? Do you think this goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
So who knows how far it goes? I think there's no question that it is unconstitutional and that there will be litigation about it, that folks will sue to protect their rights. And how far along the court hierarchy it has to go before that is found, I couldn't say. But I think there's no doubt that it is unconstitutional and just doesn't make any sense.
And again, this is another year where the U.S. Supreme Court's going to be, you know, tackling, again, the issue of abortion, because again, judges have changed and the power has shifted over to the right. Do you feel this is going to be a big year for this topic?
So I don't think there's ever been a slow year for the topic of reproductive freedom. I think that's been one that has been contested every single year since Roe v. Wade came down. I think the threat is more serious today than it has ever been before. But I also trust that the legal system will protect our rights. And in those cases where there are still problems, I think it is incumbent upon citizens to make sure that elected officials are doing what they want them to. I think we have a legislature in Florida that is really defying the people's will at every step. That's what the Amendment 4 story is about. That's what the overturning of ordinances at the local level is all about. And since we know that in general, Floridians actually support a woman's right to make decisions about her own health care, that's what this story is about, too. If we want to save our rights, we have to take it into our own hands and make sure elected officials know where we stand.
And as you said, the legislative session is just 2 weeks into its process, so something we'll keep an eye on. We've been talking with Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the ACLU of Florida. A correction, by the way, earlier in the conversation, we were discussing Amendment 4, restoring voting rights to former felons. That case has moved to the federal court, which will hear arguments in Atlanta tomorrow. So I just wanted to make sure I get that right. Micah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, thousands of Holocaust survivors are living in poverty. What kind of services are available to help? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today is the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Tens of thousands of Holocaust survivors are still living in the United States. Many of them we don't know about because they live in the shadows. Not everybody wants to relive and talk about what they went through. And there are some living in poverty because, well, let's face it, they're in their 90s. Some are living over 100 and they're running out of savings. The Jewish Family Services is working to help those Holocaust survivors who find themselves in need of basic care and assistance. And we're joined now by Danielle Hartman, Executive Director of Ruth and Norman Rails Jewish Family Services in Palm Beach County. Danielle, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Do we know how many Holocaust survivors are living in South Florida right now?
Well, it's interesting. So really, the last comprehensive study that was done of Holocaust survivors in South Florida was actually completed in 2005. And at that time, they said that there were approximately 12,000 Holocaust survivors living in all of South Florida. That's the tri-counties. And then in Palm Beach County specifically at that time, they quoted a statistic of 5,000 Holocaust survivors. However, there was some debate and continues to be some debate to this day whether that number was underreported, being the fact that, you, as you just mentioned, some Holocaust survivors do not want to be identified on lists. So it's unfortunately not debatable. But what I can tell you for certain is that we do have the second largest concentration of Holocaust survivors in the United States behind New York City.
You know, it's interesting, as I mentioned, I mean, you have a lot of these folks now are living into their 90s, over 100, and there's a pretty good size percentage of these folks who are living on the poverty line or below it. And I was thinking about that. Why? Well, a lot of them have outlived their savings, have outlived, you know, the what they had, and they still need basic care and need. Do we know how many people are struggling this way?
Right. So nationally, the statistic that is put out by the Claims Conference, which is the organization in New York who was created after World War II to negotiate for reparations with the German government. 5 years ago, that statistic was 25% of all Holocaust survivors live at or below poverty. Now that statistic has moved up to 30%. So 30% of all Holocaust survivors nationally are living at or below the poverty level.
So you have folks who you are helping, and there are folks who are volunteering, and there's a wide range of stories here in Palm Beach County. One of the volunteers you have is a survivor named Samuel Ron, and he actually shared a little bit of his story with us this morning. Let's take a listen.
I'm a Holocaust survivor from Poland, and I'm 95 years old, and I spent five years and 9 months under German jurisdiction, half of the time in concentration camps.
How did you find your way to the U.S.?
I come to the U.S. in 1955. I spent 10 years in Israel right after the war. I fought two wars in Israel. I was wounded in the military. I moved to Canton, Ohio in 1955 because I had my parents who survived the war too. My father survived the war. My mother survived the war. My brother died in Mauthausen. But we went to Ohio because we had an uncle who came here in 1904 to Lima, Ohio. So he brought the family. So finally, I took 10 years, my father, to take me out from Israel to Ohio.
Danielle, Samuel, is a volunteer, but also does require some help. Tell me a little bit more about his story.
Right. So Sam is a special person. I actually had the opportunity to travel to Poland with Sam and hear his story and see where he actually lived and visit the concentration camps that were part of this terrible history. And Sam is unique. You know, he actually serves on our Holocaust Advisory Board, which is a group of Holocaust survivors who help us make decisions on emergency financial assistance for more needy Holocaust survivors. We get the majority of our funding to take care of our local survivors from the Claims Conference, which is the organization I mentioned earlier. We get several million dollars. They're giving our community almost $16 million a year, and over 80% of those funds go directly to pay for home care so that Holocaust survivors can remain at home until the last breath that they take, where they feel most comfortable. So we actually pay for home care. We pay for transportation. We pay for dental work and medical bills. We pay for emergency financial assistance. They have case managers available to them to help guide them throughout the way. We also provide socialization opportunities, Meals on Wheels. We really, our goal is to provide everything that they need to age in place where they feel most comfortable.
I'm talking with Danielle Hartman, Executive Director of the Rails Jewish Family Services in Palm Beach County. And as I mentioned, today marks the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And many survivors living in the United States right now are struggling with basic needs. As Danielle told us, up to 30% are living at or below the poverty line, and they need basic help. You know, Danielle, when you think about the anniversary of something like this, the liberation of Auschwitz, what does that anniversary mean to the survivors? I wonder what kind of stories they tell you.
Well, you know, every survivor has their own unique history and story, and I've been fortunate in my position to hear many, many stories from survivors. I think, you know, for some people, it's a day of reflection. I think for most survivors, it's a day of triumph over evil, of triumph of the strength of will and of humankind. And today, the fact that you're interviewing me today is very auspicious, being the 75th anniversary of the liberation. It's a day that is very special. You know, we mark the day. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day in general, but the fact that it's the day of liberation from Auschwitz is extra special today.
You know, something that I find fascinating in all the years of doing this job and having had the chance to talk to a lot of Holocaust survivors is they have this strength, you know, like this energy, this passion, considering what they went through. And it seems almost as if they're tougher for it. They're stronger than a lot of other people their age because of what they went through.
Yes, I actually recently read a foreword to a book on someone who survived, who was from Lublin, and it says in the introduction that survivors are stronger than iron, they're stronger than steel, and I think that resiliency is what kept them alive through the Holocaust and what kept them living as long as they are right now. You know, the average age of Holocaust survivors that we're seeing is in the mid-90s. You mentioned we do have many survivors living into their hundreds. Nobody expected that. So in addition to outliving their resources, there are many studies that show Holocaust survivors age differently, and they have more health conditions. They have dental issues. They have osteoporosis. They're more prone to depression. And yet, they're here and they're a resilient. I like to say they're a hardy people, but I think you're right. There was a resiliency there that enabled them to survive this terrible, tragic, evil past. Yeah.
You know, one of the important experiences for some survivors is to go back to Europe to educate students about the atrocities of the Holocaust. And there's an event too. The event is called the March of the Living. And Samuel told us a little bit about why he goes back.
Yeah, I've been back to Poland on my own many times, but the marches, I'm going because I need to help educate the kids, tell them what happened and what they have to be better people and better Jews. And so we go for a week to Poland and a week to Israel. The way this is organized is that the first week in Poland, we go to the Yom HaShoah, it's commemoration day for the Holocaust. And then when we go to Israel, it's Independence Day. So it's one of the best programs for Jewish kids. We get 12,000 people from all over the world.
Danielle, going back to Europe, going back to some of these places, and of course the March of the Living, it's really important for a lot of these folks.
Yes, yes. And as more and more Holocaust survivors are dying, it becomes even more important. I actually did the March of the Living myself, and I had the honor of being with Sam. And, you know, it has a profound effect on adults and children who go and have the opportunity to walk through the death camps, walk through the concentration camps. And I would say I've never met anybody who didn't go on that trip that didn't have some sort of profound impact on their life. And it's very special. And yes, all as many Holocaust survivors who are here and able-bodied to go, they do go back to see the atrocities and remember.
Yeah. Something you said a little while ago, I don't want to let this slip by, but one of the services you provide is trying to help people, you know, to get home care. This goes to the PTSD that they struggle with, but it's better for them to be at home, to be in a home, not in a nursing facility, but to actually be at home instead. Why?
Right. So there are a lot of triggers that can happen, which seem innocent enough and cause actual PTSD to occur. It could be something as simple as turning on a shower. It could be something as simple as asking to be standing in lines. It could be pet therapy where somebody completely with the best intentions brings a German Shepherd into the nursing home and they have a traumatic experience from that. So studies have shown that Holocaust survivors, more than other older adults, do better when they age in place at home where they feel most comfortable. I'd like to go back to one point about them living longer and outliving their resources. You know, Holocaust survivors are different than other older adults because at, like in Sam's case, he was lucky enough that his parents survived the war, but many survivors had no siblings or no parents that survived the war, and they had nothing. They had no past generational wealth to help them live into their adult life. So unfortunately, Holocaust survivors, you know, even the ones that were lucky enough to come to the United States and start over, struggled, but they weren't able to ever recreate the wealth that they had, which put them in a lower economic level in some cases. There are other Holocaust survivors, and Sam is one of them, who was fortunate to do very well in his career and in his life. But there's so many more that struggled, in some cases because of the anxiety and the depression and the mental health issues that precluded them to really living their life like every other older adult.
Daniel Hartman is the executive director of Rails Jewish Family Services in Palm Beach County. Danielle, thank you so much for sharing with us and these stories on such an important day.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, talking about the Holocaust, wondering, how is it being taught in schools? We had a conversation with Linda Medvin. She's the director of Florida Atlantic University's Center for Holocaust and Human Rights Education. And she works closely with Florida teachers on how to teach and develop curriculum around the issue of the Holocaust, around the history. She joined us last year to talk about where she sees blind spots in the current education system. And of course, we want to hear from you. How were you taught about the Holocaust, and how would you teach it today? Send us a note to sundial@wlrnnews.org, or you can find us on social media at WLRNSundial. Now, here's to my conversation with Linda Medvin.
I think that many teachers are afraid of the subject because they don't know enough about it to teach it effectively. They don't have the historical background. They may think the perception is that only a Jewish teacher should be teaching the Holocaust, but it's a history course. It's history. They're just afraid. They're afraid of the ramifications of what happens if they say something wrong in their classroom. They're afraid of using a book. We've had incidents where kids hear something that they may or may not agree with, or a parent may or may not agree with, because it's not what they learned about the Holocaust. And so the kickback in the classroom to these teachers makes them kind of apprehensive. And then we have the Holocaust passionate teachers who get so involved in it and so enmeshed in it that it becomes disproportionate to what they're teaching in other subjects.
I recall going back, you know, to the 80s when I was growing up, but that the Holocaust is something that was taught usually during in history class when you're just studying World War II. But as you're saying, there is so much more to the story. To get the full context, you have to look beyond just that.
And you know, we're limited in Florida and in many other states that we need to teach to the standards of what is put forward and what the state legislature and the Commissioner of Education have for our state standards. And the Holocaust is not specifically mentioned in any subject area because we have pushed to make it integrated and interdisciplinary and cross-curricular. There's no reason that an economics teacher can't teach about the Holocaust when they talk about the inflation and the economic conditions in Germany. There's no reason why a science teacher can't use the genetics of who was actually determined to be Jewish or about the other, some of the other victims in your science classes. I wrote at one time a curriculum for PE of designing an exercise program in a confined space in conjunction with Anne Frank. So there's no limit to it. And it could go anywhere, any teacher, any art teacher, any music teacher. There's lots of things out there.
What do we get wrong about the Holocaust?
Well, it's not just, there's a lot of good that came out of the Holocaust. There's good people that did things that saved others. There's a lot of information that's come out of the Holocaust. It's the most documented piece of history ever. The Germans, for everything else, were great documentarians. And we need to use those lessons, the things that we've learned from this time in history. And every day more and more comes forward just because it's a progression. It's not dead history. We need to use those lessons to move forward so that it's relevant to our students, it's relevant to our teachers, because they're the ones that have to take us into the next century.
We have heard from listeners, one in particular, who emailed us, Yvonne, who said, every time I hear about anything about the Holocaust, it's always stated that 6 million Jews were slaughtered. When is it going to be made clear that not only Jews were annihilated, but 5 million more people of other ethnic backgrounds, religions, who were considered, quote, imperfect, end quote, due to mental illness or homosexuality or other? When we talk about the Holocaust, are we putting all the focus on, you know, again, the impact of what Nazis were trying to do to the Jews, and we skip all these other groups that were also targeted?
Our first information about the Holocaust came from the survivors, and the survivors were usually the Jewish survivors. So they were our first point of information. And as more information has come forward, we do teach about the other victims. We teach about the homosexuals being targeted. We teach about the Jehovah's Witnesses. We teach about the Roma and the Sinti. But in a classroom setting with all the other things that a teacher has to do and is responsible for, and the accountability and the data that they need to produce, there's a limited amount of time. So it's easier to just to focus on one piece. So it's a whole learning experience. And yes, we need to talk about the other victims because there were many other victims, and it all falls into place. And the more exposure we get, you can pick any topic. We did a whole piece on women as being part of their being a gender piece. We did a whole piece about immigration, which certainly is just the immigration of anybody getting out of Europe at that time. But we did it with the Holocaust in the Western Hemisphere, before, during, and after. It certainly hit home in our South Florida community because we have many people here who this is their second destination. Their families first left Europe and went to Cuba or other parts of South America and right. then came here. So, you know, what's good for one school is not necessarily right. good for another school.
Let me finish with this, Linda, only because of time. Of the yes. challenge that we face today is the fact that with social media, you've got groups online spreading a lot of hate, spreading the denial. How do you challenge that misinformation?
Well, education is our best hope against hatred. That's what we can do.
And that was my conversation with Linda Medvin. She's the director of the Florida Atlantic University Center for Holocaust and Human Rights Education. And she works closely with Florida teachers on how to teach and develop curriculum around the Holocaust. And you can find resources to teach about the Holocaust at WLRN.org. And that's Sundial for this Monday, January 27th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, there are prisoners across the state of Florida that are serving outdated criminal sentences
for drug offenses. A new study out by FSU found that women and Hispanics are being disproportionately impacted by these sentences. We spoke with the Miami Herald's Emily Mahoney about the study's findings and how Miami-Dade County is approaching things very differently. Plus, the Super Bowl is coming up. It's this Sunday. How much money can local businesses like restaurants and hotels expect to make? Now, some reports have the number about hundreds of millions of dollars for the region every time a Super Bowl comes through town. But we talked to a sports economist who says that real number, probably a lot lower than you think. Finally, a reminder, you can still join the Sundial Book Club. This month, we've been reading Don Davies' memoir, Mothers of Sparta. Did you read it? What'd you think? Share your thoughts. Find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. By the way, coming up on Thursday, we're going to have a panel discussion about some of the issues that Dawn brings up in her book. And we're going to mention the book for the month of February. I'll give you a hint. Cats. That's all I'm going to tell you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, find us online, WLRN.org. Also, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, and that's one of the best ways to message us if you have any comments or questions, at WLRN Sundial, by the way. Or you can email us, sundial@WLRNnews.org. Don't forget, find the podcast on iTunes. Listen anytime. We're back again tomorrow at 11 a.m. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.